today's main message, we'll have Mr. Vance Stinson.
Good morning. In the second month after the children of Israel left Egypt, they began to complain. They said, "Remember the flesh pots back in Egypt? Remember the bread that we had? We were full every evening. Now, Moses, look what you've done. You brought us out here in this wilderness to starve us to death." So this was the complaint that they registered. And of course, it wasn't really against Moses. God said, "It's against me. It's against God," because he's the one who brought them out there. Moses was merely the instrument. God had performed the miracles, the great signs and wonders, showing that he was indeed God. And he brought them there, and that should have been quite enough for them. But no, they were complaining now because they missed the meat, the pots of meat, and all the bread and the fullness they had in Egypt. But then God intervened. He stepped into the picture. And let's read about that in Exodus chapter 16, see what God proposes here. Exodus chapter 16, beginning in verse 4. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily.'" So Moses tells the people, at evening you're going to have the meat that you're seeking. So indeed, quails came in, and they had the meat that evening. He said, and tomorrow you're going to have the bread that you want. And when the children of Israel went out the next day after the dew lifted, they saw something on the ground, kind of strange, like little round things. And they said, "What is this?" And it turns out to be what was later called manna, which means what or what's it? What is it? They didn't know, something they hadn't seen before. But it was a miracle. God rained manna for 40 years on the children of Israel in the wilderness so that they could use it to make their bread. They boiled it or baked it or whatever they did with it. They prepared it in certain ways. And Moses says, now, be sure and whatever you gather today, use it today. Because if you try to put it up overnight, in the morning you're going to find that it stinks. It's spoiled. It's full of worms. And what did the people do? Well, some of them obviously decided they would put it up overnight so they'd have some for tomorrow, rather than go out the next day like God had instructed through Moses and gather the manna for that day. So what happened? They got up the next morning, they looked at their supply of manna, and sure enough, had worms working in it. It had a real bad smell to it, not fit to eat. And this went on day after day. They were to gather the manna, and they did, I guess learning that they couldn't let it stay overnight or it would ruin. And then on the sixth day, something marvelous happened. God says, you will gather a double portion this day because tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath. And you will keep the Sabbath. You will not work. You will not go out and gather the manna. I will see to it that it is preserved throughout the Sabbath and you can have 2 days' supply gathered in this one day. So lo and behold, it happened. They gathered the manna. They ate their portion for that day. They kept the other portion overnight, and it didn't ruin. So obviously this was to instill in the children of Israel God's Sabbath and instill it as a repeating cycle, something to be done week after week. This is your week, the seven-day week, the last day of the week being my Sabbath. So that he was instilling this principle in their minds. Now, of course, on the sixth day, you know, you could guess what happened. Or I should say on the seventh day, some of the people tried to go out and gather some manna. They were told not to, but they did anyway, just as they tried to keep some of it up overnight, even though they were told not to. As God said, I'm giving you this to test you, to see if you will obey me or not. Well, look at Exodus, still the same chapter, chapter 16, and notice what happened in verse 22. It says, and it was so on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregations came and told Moses. Then he said, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up to the morning as Moses commanded. It did not stink, nor were there any worms. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. We've already discussed this. He's instilling this principle here. Now drop on down to verse 30. It says, so the people rested on the seventh day, and the house of Israel called its name manna, and it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And let's see, I think I'm missing the verse here that I was looking for, but the point is, in this text here, someplace in the text, it tells us that some of the people tried to gather manna on the seventh day. And God says, how long? Well, here it is, verse 28. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? So, again, we find Israel tested again, some of them failing the test. The next mention of the Sabbath is over in Exodus chapter 20, and it's right there in the heart of the Ten Commandments. And God says, remember the Sabbath day, verse 8, to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. Now, obviously, if they couldn't go out and gather manna, they couldn't go out and gather anything else, could they? They were not to do harvesting that day, either then or later when they were in the land, when the manna ceased and when they were harvesting their own crops. So they were not to do any work. You nor your son nor your daughter nor your male servant or your female servant nor your cattle nor your stranger who is within your gates. Doesn't matter who you are. If you dwell in this land, you're not to do any work. No gathering manna, no gathering grain, no work. It's pure and simple. And he reiterates this over and over and over. You don't work on the Sabbath. In Exodus chapter 31. Well, first, before we get there, let's review what we have so far. First, God gave Israel the Sabbath before the law was given. We understand that, don't we? He gave it before the law was given here at Mount Sinai. The Sabbath commandment was a test commandment because he said, I'm giving you this instruction concerning the manna, the gathering of manna, to test you to see if you'll obey me. So the Sabbath was interwoven in that, and it's obviously then the fourth commandment is a test commandment. And as I said, the command to keep holy the Sabbath is right there in the heart of the Ten Commandments, which it means it's a part of the indivisible law that God thundered himself from Mount Sinai. Now, in Exodus 31, we discover something else about the special day. Go over there to Exodus chapter 31. Exodus 31, and we'll start reading in verse 12. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So what? The Sabbath is a sign, a sign. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. So this is how serious it was. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested, he ceased, he was refreshed. So we see here that the Sabbath is a sign between God and his people. It is a perpetual covenant. And once again, its importance is emphasized in the stern warning that anyone who works on the Sabbath was to be put to death. Now we find some further instructions in many other passages. One of those is in Exodus 35. You turn over there to Exodus chapter 35. And the first two or three verses there. And Moses gathered all the congregation of Israel, the children of Israel, together, and said to them, these are the words which the Lord has commanded you to do. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day shall be a holy day for you, a Sabbath of rest of the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. Now, I'm emphasizing these for, I'm going to read, leading to a point later on. Anyone who does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day. No gathering of manna, no work of any sort, no kindling of a fire in any of your dwellings. Now, what is this kindling of a fire in relation to? Some have guessed that because in the following chapters, God describes the construction of the tabernacle, which involved kindling a fire and heating the metals and all of this. They're saying you should stop working on the tabernacle on the Sabbath. But it says there's no, you're not to kindle fire in any of your dwellings. I take it to mean anywhere they are. I take that to mean you're not to be cooking like you do on the other days. You don't prepare foods like you do on other days. Of course, food preparation involved more than just turning on an eye. You understand that. You know, you filled up pots, you built the fire. So he's saying you don't carry on your day-to-day duties of preparing food. And for the women in that society, I think it was an all-day thing. It was more than just, simply throwing a couple of eggs in a pan, and there's your breakfast. So the point here is that God is restricting, putting great restrictions on the Sabbath. He's emphasizing these things, and he's emphasizing that this is so serious that if you violate it, you will be put to death. Thank you. And indeed, we find some examples, or at least one example, of somebody being put to death for violating the Sabbath. If we go over to Numbers chapter 15. Numbers chapter 15. And in verse 32. Now, while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. How many of you gathered any sticks this morning? When it gets a little colder, you think some of you might go out and gather some sticks on the Sabbath? Well, when you do that, when you get to church, after services, just step out back. We've got something for you out here. If we apply this law the way that some people might want to apply it, hopefully not. But notice what it says here. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Yeah, there was some uncertainty here. Then the Lord said to Moses, the man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. For what? Picking up sticks on the Sabbath. So, are you going to keep picking up sticks on the Sabbath? Now, go to some other examples. Let's go all the way over to Nehemiah. Book of Nehemiah. Then I'll lead to the main point that I wish to make. In Nehemiah, this was in a time of restoration. This is when the people, many of them at least, those had been taken away in the Babylonian captivity, had now returned to the land, and there was reconstruction going on, restoration going on, renewal and revival. All this taking place in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Obviously, there were still some problems there. Still some problems. The people had to work their ways through them. But they did look back, at least. A great number of them looked back at their ancestors, and they realized that idolatry and their ancestors copying the nations around them, taking up their religious practices, their idolatry, their Sabbath breaking, and so on, doing all the things the nations had done and going drifting into idolatry had resulted in their being sent to Babylonian captivity to start with. And so they look at this and say, we don't want this to happen again. Here we are back in our own land. Reconstruction is going on, and we've got to make sure that this does not happen again. So the people, many of the leaders of the people, we start reading about it in verse chapter 8. We won't read it, but we see here that Ezra reads the law to the people. We see that the Feast of Tabernacles is observed. It's a revival of sorts taking place here. Then in chapter 9, we see that the people confess their sins, and they want to make sure that things are right with them now, and they don't get driven out of the land again. And it's a very poetic section here in chapter 9 that describes the history of Israel and their rebellion and their repentance and their rebellion and then God's mercy and all the mercy He's shown them. And then they decide they're going to make a covenant to make sure that they do not drift back into idolatry and the sins of their fathers. So in chapter 10, it's the people seal the covenant. It gives you a list of names there of the people who were involved, who were the leaders in this movement. And then the covenant was sealed. In verse 28, we read this. Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who had separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding, these joined with their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and an oath, that is an oath, to seal the oath, there's a curse if you break it, to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God and His ordinances and His statutes. We would not give our daughters as wives to the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for ours. Why? What's going on here? This is not talking about because they're of different race. It's not what it's about. If you read the context carefully, in fact, we'll read a section of it over in chapter 13, you see what the problem was with intermarriage. It had to do with going back into idolatry. In chapter 13, it says, concerning this very thing, verse 26, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things, by taking all these wives to himself from the foreign nations? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused him to sin, even him. This man who was so loved, this man was such a good ruler, but having these pagan women caused him to sin. So it's not, some people like to use this as a racial issue. That's not what is in view here. What is in view here is the fact that intermarrying with the peoples of the land would lead the people back into idolatry. And therefore, they would lose the land again. They'd be taken in another captivity, be scattered all over the world as a result of that. That was the concern. Now, you know, you could make the argument. I'm interjecting something here that a point I'll come back to later, maybe not this specific point, but a principle. The Apostle Paul, I guess, couldn't read his Bible, somebody might argue, because he allowed people to stay married to their pagan husbands and wives. In fact, he encouraged it. As long as those people were willing to dwell with them, the believer, he says, you stay married. Now let them go if they don't want to be with you, if they don't tolerate your religious views, then they want to leave, then, you know, you're free. But let them leave. That's their choice. But here, there's not much choice. Ezra and Nehemiah says, you get rid of them. So they got rid of their wives. And again, the problem was that they knew that if they allowed this intermarriage to take place with the people of the land, that pretty after a while, rather than the people of the land beginning to worship Israel's God, the true God, they would start adopting their practices, and back into idolatry they would go. So that was the problem here. Now, continuing on here, he says in verse 31, if the peoples of the land brought wares or any grain to sell on the Sabbath day, we would not buy it. This is part of the covenant that they made. We would not buy it from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day, and we would forego the seventh year's produce in the exacting of every debt. Also, we made ordinances for ourselves to exact from ourselves yearly one-third of a shekel for the service of the house of God. So here, these are the rules they established for themselves in order to prevent apostasy once again. And the idea here was that, well, in fact, this is what was going on. People from the nations, people of the people of the lands, both there and surrounding lands, would come in, and you had the people of Israel reestablishing themselves there, and they would do business with them. They would trade with them, naturally. They'd bring in their carts full of produce and whatnot, and they would sell it. And then Nehemiah expresses his concerns about this a few chapters over. Going over to chapter 13. We are in 13. Verse 15. 13 and verse 15. It says, in those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, and I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish and all kinds of goods, and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? So you see what was happening here, don't you? You have these people back in the land, these people whose ancestors received all this instruction that we just read about regarding the Sabbath day. They knew, undoubtedly, the law had been read to them by Ezra. They must have known, surely, about the man who was put to death for picking up sticks. They must have known about the manna and how God said, how long will you refuse to obey my commandments? When the people went out in the field and gathered the manna. And yet here they were in the holy city itself, in the land of promise, right in the heart of the land, allowing these outsiders to come in and set up shop, and they were treating the Sabbath just like any other day. That was their land. That was God's land. Understand, it's very important to keep in context. This was God's land, the land He had given to them, and the land in which the covenant was to be in force. It was their land, God's land, and outsiders who came in had to recognize that and respect it. Otherwise, the people would become just like the surrounding nations. Now, let's go now to some New Testament passages and see some things here that are very important. I'm not going to read Matthew chapter 5 and verses 17 through 19. You probably could quote those to me. We've read them many times in the past. It's very clear Jesus did not come to abolish the law. He said He didn't come to abolish but to fulfill. He said, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And you see throughout the Sermon on the Mount that He doesn't overthrow the commandments at all. He explains their true meaning, what they had meant all along, because they had become corrupted by this point. So Jesus was, from the point of view of an outsider looking on, was definitely an observant Jew. He was on the same page as Ezra and Nehemiah, no question about it. Some people say that he was a kind of a rebel. He came and overturned the existing system that God established back under Moses. No, he didn't. They came and spoke against it, spoke against the temple. No, he didn't. You know, he came into the temple and the money changers were there. He saw their corruption. He overturned their tables and he said, you make my father's house a den of thieves. So how did he view the temple? It's his father's house. It was a holy institution. When he cleansed a leper, he said, go show yourself to the priest and take the appropriate offering with you. He respected those institutions. He was, as I say, an observant Jew. He said that the Pharisees tithe meticulously, but they neglected the weightier matters of the law. He says, you ought to observe these weightier matters, but don't leave the meticulous tithing undone. So again, Jesus was an observant Jew on the same page with Ezra and Nehemiah, no question about it. You could spend a whole sermon on that subject showing clearly that he respected those institutions normally called Jewish institutions, such as the Sabbath, the temple, the priesthood, etc., etc. Yet, I want to show you something here that may surprise some people, and I think it is very instructive, especially when it comes to the question of is it okay or not okay to eat out in restaurants on the Sabbath day. And this is the whole thing so far has been leading up to this, because this is a question that has been asked again and again, and it's caused division. And when someone a long time ago asked me to address the subject, I thought, okay, maybe so, and I thought about it some more. I thought, no, I think to address it will only be to contribute to the division, because if I take one side or the other, it's going to offend those who are opposed to what I'm saying. And yet you've got to have a position. You've got to draw a line somewhere. And if someone disagrees with me, and you have your own opinion about how these things ought to be done, then, and you have your conscience there to deal with, then you better follow your conscience. But by the same token, a church, an organization, a group of people, if they're going to do things together, then they have to have some kind of guidance, some kind of guidelines, and they have to know why they do what they do, and so on, in regards to things like this. So I'm going to present a position today, and I do think that my position, the position I present, is in alignment with all the rest of the Church of God International Ministry, as far as that goes, the UCG and other churches of God. Let's go to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, after having pointed out that Jesus was definitely an observant Jew, on the same page with Ezra and Nehemiah, he upheld the law. That means all those laws back there in the Old Testament, you know, he didn't come and negate any of them, including the Sabbath laws that we read about. But he came to explain their proper use and their proper role. In Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. We read this and say, oh, these stupid Pharisees again. Boy, they were just Pharisees. You know, they were really strict and rigid. Think about it for a moment, though. If you couldn't go out and gather manna, if you couldn't even go out and get and pick up sticks without getting killed, who are these people? Who do they think they are that they can go out in the grain fields and pluck grain? You know what else they were doing? They were preparing it. Oh, they weren't cooking it, boiling it, but they had to roll it up in their hands, blow away the husk, and then eat the grain. If it's not okay to go out and gather manna, why is it okay to go out and pluck grains or grain or ears of grain? Why is that? If it's not okay to pick up sticks, how do you justify that? So you see, the Pharisees seem to have had a point. They seem to have had a point here. Can you disagree with them? Can you say you don't agree with them? The reason you don't agree with them is because Jesus Christ says they're wrong. But that ought to give us pause to think about some things here and how we cite these laws that are back there and specific applications of those laws and then how they might or might not apply today. We need to look back and see, look at this example and see what we can draw from those other laws like that. Because if you look at the manna law, you don't go out and gather manna on the Sabbath. You look at that law about not doing any work on the Sabbath. Not even picking up sticks. Not kindling a fire. It's hard to justify. If you take it across the board, those circumstances back then, and apply it to every circumstance, it's hard to justify plucking grain on the Sabbath, isn't it? Yeah. Don't hesitate. Go ahead and admit it. Yes. The reason we know that's a wrong concept is because Jesus Christ himself says so. And he's the final authority. But we ought to ask the question, why does he say so? You can see what we have here. What the problem with the Pharisees was this. Here we have a classic example of taking rules or regulations, let's put it that way, regulations pertaining to a specific situation and taking those regulations and trying to lift them and applying them to another entirely different situation. And you can't do that. And I propose to you that that's exactly what we do when we take the book of Nehemiah and the no buying and selling on the Sabbath rule and try to lift it and then put it over here in our situation when we go out and enjoy the Sabbath by eating in restaurants. It's out of context, folks. Out of context. Very important principle here. The Pharisees did improperly interpret the law because they took those rules or those regulations pertaining to specific times and places under specific circumstances and tried to apply them to something totally different. It's wrong. Let's read on here. Continuing on in Matthew 12 and he goes on, Jesus goes on and says, but he said to them, in verse 3, have you not read that what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. You know, you go back and read the law, that's exactly what it says. But these were special circumstances. This was not your day-to-day circumstances. So David and his men ate the showbread. Okay? Verse 5, or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? How in the world can that be possible? Well, the commandment says you shall do no work, none. You don't kindle fires, you don't pick stuff up, you don't do anything like that. You do no work. And yet you go back to the book of Numbers, long chapter 10, I believe. You go back there and read what God commanded these priests to do on the Sabbath. They did double time. They worked hard on the Sabbath. So from the point of view of the Sabbath as a day of rest, a day that you don't work, the priests were profaning it. And from that point of view, they broke it, in a sense. But he says they're blameless. Why? Because you can't take that specific commandment and apply it to every situation precisely the same way. The priest had a function, and their sacrificial service was in alignment with the meaning and purpose of the Sabbath. It's kind of like years ago, before I knew anything about which, I grew up thinking Sunday was the seventh day of the week, that was a Sabbath. And I remember I was in Florida or someplace, and I heard somebody who was selling boat rides grumbling about his preacher. And, this is one of those churches that takes Sunday to be the Sabbath. He's grumbling about how his preacher said something to him about continuing to work on Sunday and not coming to church. And he thought he made a brilliant point. He said, well, you know, that preacher works. So I told him. I said, you work, don't you? Get paid pretty good, too, don't you? You know, and I didn't know beans about anything back then. I thought, that's about the stupidest argument I've ever heard. Because the preacher is up there, you know, he gets up there on Sunday. You can apply this to the Sabbath. Gets up and expounds what he understands from the Word of God. He talks about Jesus Christ. He helps people, you know, straighten out their lives, improve themselves. And there, this guy's out selling boat rides, and he compares those two things. Well, you can go out and work in the field all day, or go to whatever, do whatever, gather sticks all day. It's not quite the same as working real hard in preparing the sacrifices. It's all a part of the worship of God, is it? No. But this is what Jesus is talking about here. He goes on and says, "Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple." Of course, this is the main point of this section. He's pointing out that he's greater than the temple. He's the Messiah. He's greater than the temple. And here my disciples are with me. And he goes on to say there that he's the Lord of the Sabbath. But there's some important principles come in here. Verse 7. "But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless." Do you know what that means? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. He's quoting from Hosea 6 and verse 6. Well, you know, he's just talked about the temple. What happens in the temple? Sacrifice. And you go back and read from the Old Testament the law of sacrifice, you get the impression almost that those sacrifices are more important than the Sabbath. Because after all, the priests had to work hard on the Sabbath to offer the sacrifices. And God said, you see to it that you offer them exactly, precisely, in the manner in which I instruct you. So they were very important. And yet Jesus says here, quoting the Scriptures, God says, I desire something else above sacrifice. As important as it is, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Mercy, of course, God's own mercy is the epitome, the standard of all mercy. But he desires expressions of mercy from us. And that's where human need comes in. The whole thing here involves human need. David and his men hungry. Christ, his disciples, hungry, an expression of mercy or love or kindness, generosity, all those things belong to the same category, would be in letting them eat. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. If you'd understood this, he said, then you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Again, that is the main point. But this is also instructive in some of the how-to questions. And in showing us that you can't just take a set of instructions that belong to a particular set of circumstances and lift them over and apply them to a totally different set of circumstances. In Mark chapter 2, we find the same story told. We find something else added in verse 27. "And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath." What does that mean? It was made for the benefit of man, the Sabbath was. It was not made so that man could have something to keep. Oh yes, it served as a test commandment for Israel, but the Sabbath was made for the benefit of man. It was not made to impose a burden on man. And when you start taking scriptures out of context pertaining to one situation and then take them over to an entirely different situation and apply them, oftentimes you will impose a burden on people. And that's what the Pharisees were doing. The Sabbath was made for the benefit of man. Not man for the benefit of the Sabbath. It's not like God made his Sabbath and said, now I've got to make somebody to keep it. I like my Sabbath so much, I'm going to have somebody to keep it. No, he made man first. And then he sanctified the Sabbath for man's benefit. That's the point here. In John chapter 5, we find another interesting account. In John chapter 5, and in verse 6, this is a certain man who went down to the pool of Bethesda, and when the waters were stirred, people would get into the pool, people who were sick or ailing, in hopes that they would be healed as a result. So there was this man down there, and he was lame. He couldn't get to the pool, and there's nobody there to take him, put him in the pool. So when Jesus saw him lying there, verse 6, and knew that he already had been in the condition a long time, he said to him, do you want to be made well? The sick man asked him, sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me. Jesus said to him, rise, take up your bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews, therefore, said to him who was cured, it is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. Now, Wilde's sitting there shaking her head like how dumb these Pharisees are. And I agree with her. Or they were off track here, shall we say. However, if you can't pick up sticks without getting put to death, why can you pick up your pallet and walk around with it? If you can't pick up manna without being condemned, how can you pick up your pallet? Why couldn't he just leave his pallet laying there till sundown? He can get up and walk around. Now he doesn't even need the thing. Doesn't he have another one back home? So what's the difference in picking up manna and sticks and a pallet? You see, we could make these kind of arguments, couldn't we? And evidently the Pharisees did. But again, it involves taking something, a set of instructions pertaining to a specific situation, and trying to bring it over and transpose it over something else. Doesn't work. Never was anything wrong with picking up stuff on the Sabbath as a general principle. But in the case of Israel, and under those specific circumstances, when they were just introduced to the Sabbath, God had to put special restrictions in order to make them get the point. But you don't continue with those restrictions and say, this is what God likes. He likes not picking up stuff on the Sabbath, or he gets mad about it. No, that's never was the point. Never was the point. The lesson of the manna, it was to instill within those people which day the Sabbath was and that they were to keep it perpetually. Okay? And in the case of Nehemiah, what was going on there? You see, that was the land of promise. That does not address the question, what was an Israelite to do if he were outside the land and he were sojourning in a neighbor's land? It does not address that question at all. It concerns the city of Jerusalem. It concerns the place that God had given to the covenant people. They were not to let that place, that community, become a Sabbath-breaking community. So they had to put some rules down. And we read that they made the rules. And that's fine. The rules they made were good. The rules concerning the collection of money for the house of the Lord. The rules concerning keeping the foreigners out. The rules concerning marrying pagan neighbors. And of course, the idea there, as I explained, was to keep away from idolatry. They established those rules for that set of circumstances. They were in a process of restoration and renewal. But that doesn't mean that all of those rules carry over into every other situation. And to try to say that in Canada, in the United States, down in South America, in Jamaica, in the Philippines, and you're all over the world, that people who eat in restaurants on the Sabbath are violating that rule. It's not, you can't do that. That's not what's going on. That's not the same set of circumstances. They're not in the Holy Land. And that covenant renewal is not taking place. They're individual Israelites, if you want to say that, meaning in a spiritual sense, living in lands all around the world. So again, the Nehemiah text does not even bring into question, it does not contribute anything to the question of what would an Israelite do if he's in somebody else's land. And there's a restaurant open and he's hungry. You know what I think he would do? Same thing I'd do. Go and get him something to eat. Let's go back. Speaking of Nehemiah, let's go back there to chapter 13. I want to show you something else in this text that is often overlooked. Back to Nehemiah 13 once again. Let's notice what Nehemiah said that they were to do to prevent the pagan traders, not traitors, but traders, the businessmen, from coming in and setting up shop. Notice what happened here. Verse 19. So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be open till after the Sabbath. Now, after the Sabbath, those guys could come in and trade as long as they're not selling anything illegal or doing anything wrong, as long as they were not influencing the people in any wrong way. So then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. He did what? He put guards at the gate. Guards stood at the gate Friday night. They stayed there all day on Saturday. I thought you're not supposed to go out of your dwelling. In the previous law, it said stay in your dwellings and don't go out. And here they are. They had to be outside their dwellings. But of course, again, that original instruction about staying in your dwellings had to do with not going out to pick up manna. Now the merchants and sellers, of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. This is after he shut the gates and put guards out there. Then I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. He's not talking about so they'd receive the Holy Spirit. He wasn't going to ordain some ministers. No, he's talking about doing some heavy-duty flesh-kicking. No need for any anatomical specificity here. You get the point. From that time on, they came in no more on the Sabbath. These people were posted there at the gates on the Sabbath. And if these guys wanted to come through the gates, they tried to get in. Nehemiah had given them instructions to lay hold of them, to fight them on the Sabbath. Flesh kicking on the Sabbath. Now, how do we apply that? I guess we could put some deacons at the door here. Anybody tries to get in, they could whoop up on them, as we say. No, but you get the point here. This is a specific set of circumstances here, and it called for extraordinary, regulations. And you can't take any of that and just transpose it over an entirely different set of circumstances. It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Now, let's go back to one other passage in Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah 58, this one always comes up in any discussion on the Sabbath and how to keep the Sabbath, on keeping it holy. We read this beginning in verse 13. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to rise on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. So what's he saying here? What's wrong with doing your own pleasure on the Sabbath? What does that mean? If you read the context, you see what they were doing. This is a contrast to what they were doing. They were neglecting the widows and the orphans. They were being very selfish and very self-centered in all that they did, including their business dealings. And when they worked their slaves or their servants, they worked them especially hard to make up for lost time on the Sabbath. It's not mentioned specifically in this text, I don't think, but that's the kind of thing that was going on. That was their own pleasure. Their own pleasure, their own words, were words pertaining to their own business, the things, their businesses that they operated, the things that they, the means of generating income, primarily. That's what he's talking about here. But he said, not saying there's anything wrong with pleasure, per se, on the Sabbath. He said it should be a day to delight in, a delightful day. But in the back, if you read the whole chapter in context, you see that this was the problem. In fact, in talking about fasting in verse 6, it says, is this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens rather than impose them. See, they were fasting. They were doing these things. They were mistreating their neighbors, not providing for their own in the way that they should, the orphans and the widows and so on. And yet they were fasting, coming before the Lord, lifting up holy hands or hands. I don't know how holy, but lifting up their hands and praying to God and wondering, why aren't we being blessed? He says, this is the kind of fast that I call for, just doing without food. Is the kind of sacrifice I want just offering animals on the altar? Is that it? He said, is this not the fast that I've chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, not cause them. To undo heavy burdens, not impose them. To let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry? See, this is what they were not doing. And that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out. When you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh, your own kinsmen. Then your light shall break forth like the morning. Your healing shall spring forth speedily. And then when he gets down to the instructions about the Sabbath, he's talking about essentially the same thing. You do your own pleasures, meaning your own selfish ends, your own selfish goals are met on the Sabbath. This is not the Sabbath. This is not my intention for the Sabbath. It ought to be a delight. It ought to be a day that you, well, embrace these other concepts. A day do you help the orphan and the widow. It's a day to do good. Jesus taught the same thing. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? Well, that's what Isaiah is telling. God, through Isaiah, is telling us here. So, again, to get back to the main point, and that is, we could go through many other things. I want to mention also that on the United Church of God website, there is a paper on this subject, on eating at restaurants or eating out on the Sabbath, prepared by the Doctrine Committee of the United Church of God. Now, I made a copy of that earlier this week, and I read a little part of it, but didn't read the whole thing. I was going to go ahead and incorporate some of it into my notes, but after I saw how many notes I had, after preparing my own notes, I thought, well, I don't know. There may be some things in there that we have not covered here today. I'm quite sure there are some things. So you might want to check that out. Go to their website and see what they have prepared on this subject. I've been told it's a very good article, those who have read it. A study paper really is what it is. But in any case, I think we can see the main point that I wanted to make here today, and that is you can't go back to these Old Testament texts. I'm not saying you throw out the text. I'm saying you get to the underlying meaning and you apply that. But when you start looking at specific regulations regarding such things as the buying and selling on the Sabbath in the land of promise in the time of Nehemiah, or what God told the children of Israel regarding gathering the manna, or the fact that a man was put to death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. You have to understand the context of all these things, and you can't take those specific regulations pertaining to specific times, very different from our times, and then transpose them or bring them over to an entirely different situation and set of circumstances and try to apply them in that literalistic way. You can't do that. And when we do start doing that, we wind up doing the same thing that the scribes and the Pharisees did. We start turning the Sabbath into something other than a delight. We start imposing imposing burdens on people when we do that. So let's be careful not to do it. I might also mention that, you know, there are many questions come up. What about your servant? Aren't you making your servant work? You know, a waitress or waiter in a restaurant is not my servant. He works for the owner of the restaurant. He doesn't work for me. He's there. He would serve me or anybody else that's in there, but he's not my servant. He doesn't live in my house, and I don't give him his orders. Well, I do give him my orders in one sense, but I don't give him, you know, it's not like he's under my supervision in my house. I'll give him all the rest he wants, you know. In fact, there's something could be said about that. When you go to restaurants and eat, we're going to have a potluck back here. We usually do, and it's very delightful. It involves some work on the part of some of the ladies and maybe a few of the men, but usually mostly the ladies, I have to admit that. And they do a better job than we do anyway when it comes to food preparation. But we enjoy it, don't we? We could go out to a restaurant and have the same pleasure, the same joy, and enjoy fellowshipping with each other. Some people say, yeah, but you're buying and selling. Well, yeah, you pay for your meal. You can't get out without it. Unless you fake a heart attack or something, but then you get into real problems. But you have to pay for your meal. But again, where do we get the idea that there's something wrong with paying for a meal on the Sabbath? It's not in there. You can take a regulation from the book of Nehemiah and misapply it, wrongly apply it, but you don't find any commandment against paying for a meal on the Sabbath day. And you can fellowship in a restaurant very well. You can do it very well. In fact, you don't have to clean up the dishes afterward. You know, you don't have to prepare anything beforehand. I know in some churches, and this is perfectly fine, the ladies work real hard in preparing real fine dishes week after week. And I don't have any problem with them back there. I've seen them back there warming up the stuff. I don't think they're violating the principle set forth back there when it says not to kindle a fire, because that's a different set of circumstances. But let's understand that so is the thing in Nehemiah, the instruction in Nehemiah regarding buying and selling. That's different too. That's different too. We have to look at the underlying principle, and that is that the Sabbath should be a delight. And eating in a restaurant from time to time can certainly be a delight, be a time for fellowship. And in one sense, you might say that those waiters and waitresses who are in there participate just a little bit in your Sabbath delight. So, you know, there's more to it than just simply looking at a specific law or a specific regulation set forth in Scripture and then trying to apply it across the board. You can't do that. You have to look at the intent, the overall intent of a specific regulation, and then you have to look at the law in a broader sense, and then you can determine how it applies in our time. But the main thing here is that let's be sure that we avoid the type of interpretation that ends in imposing burdens on people, things that are just not necessary. And again, I also want to emphasize that if there's anyone who disagrees with my conclusions, that's your prerogative. I would say you have to follow your conscience. But in the meantime, be very careful and refrain from condemning the innocent.